Hello, friends. My name is Samuel, and I am an alcoholic. And I'll tell you what, if you're not fired up for AA after this convention, your wood's wet. Man, oh man. How did I get here Friday night, Kathy? Oh my, what an awesome message I've heard this weekend about we need to get into the book. I love the fellowship, and the fellowship's great, and I love the meetings and all, but it's the program that gets us sober. And then Steve told us all about the part of the program that's just transformative when we make those amends. And I'm not going to talk a whole lot about that, but I just want to say that if you're going to your amends expecting to hear those three magic words, "I forgive you," you're probably not ready to do your amends, because that's not what it's all about. And then Lyle last night, oh my goodness, I've been with Lyle before on Zoom, and it's just, you know, I'm talking to him this morning, and his lovely wife Barbara, and the sage advice was, you know, just be you. So I'm going to be me. But how do you follow a lineup like that? Wow. Now, I'm told by the committee, and I want to thank the committee for even considering me to be here. I'm told by the committee that the voice of the convention changes gender every year. I'm proposing a rule change that we just have Natalie do it for about the next 4 years. Thank you, Natalie. Through the flubs and foibles, she maintained her dignity and grace. And I just want to know, I know how difficult that can be. And talk about through flubs and foibles, you know, I'm assured that there's a fresh battery in here. So I just... Oh, man. And we did the sobriety countdown last night. Those are always fun. Where I come from, they do it backwards, or you do it backwards down here. I'm not sure which. But that's always... So just a reminder, you know, is there anybody in here who's in their first year of sobriety? If you could raise your hand. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. And is there anybody in here that's in their first 90 days of sobriety? Oh, wow. Are you digging it? Not so much, huh? Okay. Yeah, we get that. We get that, you know? You know, they come here to AA and they're speaking this foreign language, and you have all these happy, shiny people, and I just want to kill somebody. I can't, you know, I understand that. And you got all these show-offs in AA, you know, we show up, and they're all dressed up, and they're smiling, and they're happy. And then there's these real show-offs, you know, they had these things that I want, you know, like a valid driver's license. And it's got an address on it. And if you show up there, they actually live there. That's adding insult to injury. Oh, my goodness. Oh, what a wonderful, wonderful weekend this has been. And if you are new to Alcoholics Anonymous and no one has cordially welcomed you here, I want to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a transformative program that can modify how you live the rest of your life without booze. And that, for this alcoholic, is just amazing. For you see, I have been rescued from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body by the grace of a loving God. And for that, I am eternally grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the rest of the story. So, Lyle and I were kidding about that out in the hall too. You know, okay, our stories are the same. Here's your story. If you've worked the 12 steps, I drank way too much. I got into trouble. I got sick. I fell down. I came to AA. I got better. The end. Is it? Can't your story fit that mold? Absolutely. Okay, I called your friends because the book tells me that I will have a host of new friends. And I don't know how many are in a host, but it's a grunch, and I probably made another 60 or 70 friends just this weekend. You know, I'm going to have to get a new phone. Not that there's anything wrong with my old phone. It's just that the contact list is like full. You know, I got to start taking people out. And how do you do that? You don't. You know, you just do old school and start writing it down, right? Or you keep all these little 3x5, these little cards, little business cards that we all have our email address, and so that's so that I can get around and keep in touch with you Because after all, togetherness is what makes this work. Because we're all crazy. We're just not all crazy on the same day. So if I'm having one of those crazy days, maybe you're not. And if you're having one of those crazy days, call me, because maybe I'm not. Call me or text me. 570-916-5305. 916-5305. 916-5305. If you call, I will answer. If I don't answer, leave a message. I will call you back. Because that's how this program works. I was born in the early 50s. My father married my mother when he came home from World War II. And they remained married until my father's death. My mother was a stay-at-home mother for the first part of my life, most of my life. And so when I hear these people have these horrible childhoods and abuse, and that's not my story. Because you see, I lived in a very small town in central Pennsylvania. My father worked for the telephone company, and I had siblings, and we were this typical white middle class American family that you see on Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best and all these other things that you're watching on TV and you're saying, oh, that's a bunch of hooey. Well, it might be a bunch of hooey to you, but that was my life. So I can't point to anything, the abuse that I had, the cause of my drinking. That small town, my parents knew everybody, we had all this freedom, or we thought we did, running in the woods, jumping in the creek, swimming, fishing, playing ball, building tree forts, all those things, right, take our bicycles wherever we wanted to go. But here's the deal, since everybody knew everybody and it was a homogeneous society, if any kid stepped out of line, it wasn't unusual for any of the adults to get in one of those upside the head and send them home. When we got home, we got disciplined. Usually my mother knew before I got there because we had a telephone. Not everyone had a telephone, but my father worked for the telephone company, so we had a telephone. And when father got home, I got disciplined again. Notice I used the word disciplined, not abused. Now, don't get me wrong. My father was not averse to corporal punishment. I got a lot of lickings growing up, and I resented that. Until when I did my four-step, I realized I deserved every darn one of them. In today's word speak Smith, whatever politically correct, they would call it obstinate defiant disorder. I was a friggin' brat. Selfish and self-centered, and I wanted my way. When I was just hitting puberty, my father got a promotion and we moved from that tiny little town to a huge city called Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Population 36,000. Yeah, everybody laughs. When I was sharing my story in Queens one time. I have a son who lives in Queens. And I said, population 36,000. And one of the guys said, you realize there's that many people in your son's apartment building. But you see, it was a huge city to me because not everybody knew my mom and dad. And not everybody was the same. There were different faiths, different religions, different races. And I was at that age where you're a hormone with feet. And so I discovered these things with skirts, and they were kind of fun to play with. And I also discovered some other things, cigarettes. And I had a keen interest in electronics. There was an electronics store in town, and I asked this guy if he could teach me some electronics. I'd like to work for him. And he agreed to do that, and he did teach me some things about electronics. But he also taught me a lot of things that a 36-year-old man had no business teaching a 12-year-old boy. Evil, vile, disgusting things. I do not need to get into the details with you on this platform, because if you can imagine it in your mind, it happened. And I voluntarily went back and subjected myself to that molestation for a period of 3 years. And why did I do that? Because he had cigarettes and he had booze, with which he supplied me liberally. And it was a secret from my goody-two-shoes parents. I told you that we were a typical family. I was raised in a mainstream Protestant religion. I know that some of you have a drug problem here. I think I see some amateur chemists out there, as a matter of fact. Other than my Vietnam experience, drugs are not part of my story. I had a different drug problem. I got drugged to Sunday school. I got drugged to church. I got drugged to Wednesday night prayer meeting. I got drugged to Thursday choir practice. Yeah. I had this firm foundation in religion, which as soon as I was able, of course, I rejected. I graduated from high school. I was an above average student with slightly above average intellect, I guess. Why didn't I do better? Because I was lazy. I didn't, maybe they never said this about you, but I sure heard it a lot. Mrs. Shively, he's not living up to his potential. Because I was lazy. And so I graduated from high school. I didn't have grades good enough to get a scholarship to any college. My parents were not well off that they could afford to send me to college. And there was this little brouhaha going on in Vietnam, and I did not want to get drafted into the Army and go there. At the time, there was still compulsory military service. If you were of a certain age, you could be forced to go into the military. Since I wasn't going to college, I didn't have a student deferment. And I thought, well, I'm not going to do that. There's got to be something better to do here. And so I came up with this brilliant plan because I'm just a brilliant guy. And I enlisted in the Navy. And the Navy gave me a bunch of special high-intensity training. It'll come to you. And an all-expense-paid trip to Southeast Asia. Yeah, it wasn't a good gig. And my dive buddy, Mike, was happened to be killed about less than the distance from here to the wallway. So I was ready to get out of there, and I told that there was a little bit of drugs in my story. I experimented with marijuana during the Vietnam experience. But that was not it for me, for a couple of reasons. First of all, it was highly illegal at the time. Possession of a small amount of marijuana was still a felony and court-martial offense. And second of all, it didn't get it for me. It just made me paranoid because it was so illegal. And booze was the big tent. It was legal. It was acceptable. Heck, it was expected. What do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you Man, oh man. Okay, so that gigs up. I'm about ready to get out of service, and this smooth-talking career counselor gets a hold of me. And he says, you know, I've looked at your test scores when you came into the service. You got some amazing scores, and you qualify for the Navy's College of Nuclear Engineering. Ooh, that sounded cool. He said, sign me up. He said, well, you know, there's some additional obligated service. I said, I don't care. Maybe I had impulse control issues even then. I don't know. So off I went to nuclear power school. I told you about my high school background. You know, I got above average grades, but I excelled at nuclear power school. The attrition rate was 50%. How do you get the equivalent of an undergraduate degree in nuclear engineering in less than 2 years? I'll tell you how. The classes are 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. That career counselor told me that it was the equivalent of a $100,000 education. I don't know if that's true or not, but back then you could go to any Ivy League school in America for that kind of money. But I do know this. If it was a $100,000 education, they crammed it up your ass a nickel at a time. It was hard. And I excelled at it. Funny thing about the military, if they're paying you and sending you to school to learn something, they actually expect you to go and learn it. And I excelled at that, came out of there, I was on the fast track, my promotions took off like a rocket ship. I'm on submarines now, I end up getting commissioned as an officer, I'm rising through the ranks, and my military career is off great. Now, as I tell my story, you're going to see that the drinking goes up and goes down and goes up and goes down as the disease progresses. And so pre-puberty, I wasn't like some of you guys who discovered booze then. But I did discover it when that 12 to 16-year-old, Ray, you know, when Chester the Molester had me in his crutches. And then after that, I wasn't hanging out with the kids in school that were drinking and everything, so I wasn't drinking then. Graduated from high school, went in the Navy. You know, they drink in the Navy. And so started to drink there, but once again, not to interfere with my training. Then during the Vietnam experience, we just drank, period, all the time. So after that, in nuclear power school, you know, how much drinking was there then? None. There wasn't any time to drink. It was hard. You had your nose in the book or you had your nose on the pillow. Those were the two choices for that whole 2 years. You were studying or you were asleep. There wasn't any drinking. Then get into the submarines, and guess what? Now we've got some time to drink. One of the submarines that I was on pulled into this port that has some very strange customs and a very unusual dialect called Pascagoula, Mississippi. For this Pennsylvania boy, I might as well have been on Mars. So my roommate says, hey, I'm going to a church social. Do you want to go? Now, remember, I told you I was raised in a mainstream Protestant religion. And so all throughout this time, I'm going to chapel or I'm going to church. You know, I go most Sundays, you know, if I'm off. I'm trying to be the good guy. Why am I going to church? Because I'm the spiritual giant? No, because that's what to do. And, you know, I'm flipping a fiver in the plate if I got it, you know. And I'm singing in the church choir, drunk, sober, or hungover. You know what? It doesn't matter. And so he says, you want to go to church social? I said, nah, not tonight. And he said, well, it's roller skating. I said, I'm in, because at the time I was doing a lot of roller skating. I didn't know he had set me up with a blind date. And so he introduced me to this little girl. I thought she was about 12 because she had the figure of a 12-year-old. And I didn't care much for her, and she didn't care much for me because, well, she thought I was a show-off. Can you imagine that? A month later, we were engaged. Six months after that, we were married. Because in that society, 6 months is an acceptable engagement, because if she's in trouble, it'll be showing by then. And in 3 weeks, we will celebrate our 58th anniversary, and that's my wife, Brenda.
48, did I say 58? 48. It only seems like 58. Nope.
48. 48 years on the 16th of next month. So if there's anybody that deserves a medal from Alcoholics Anonymous, it's sure not me, because I didn't do anything except do what you guys told me to do. Took a set of actions that I didn't think would work and that I didn't want to do. And as a result of doing those actions, a miracle happened. God revealed himself to me. And how did that happen? Well, the drinking is progressing. I retire from the Navy. Very successful career. I start a couple of companies. One makes money, one loses money, one breaks even. Landed a job with a company out of St. Louis as their regional engineer, had the Northeast United States. They're paying me an obscene salary. They're paying me commission on all my sales. They're paying me royalties on all my patents. And here's the kicker, an unlimited expense account. And I'm expected to entertain. I'm leaving the house on Sunday night or Monday morning, depending on where I'm going, getting back on Friday night or Saturday morning, depending on where I've been. Different hotel every night. Guess what? I'm not drinking the cheap stuff anymore. I'm drinking top shelf, you know? American Express bill, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 a month. I don't care. I'm not paying it. Holy moly, you talk about the ideal job for an alcoholic. And that's when I probably crossed over the threshold. So before all that happened, these little ones start coming along. I don't know how that happens because, you know, I'm at sea all the time, and I'm not drinking when I'm at sea. And when I come home, you know, I come home, and you know, and Brenda and I talk, and then and these little ones start coming along. And I, you know, Bill says in his story, I had arrived. There I am. We own a house. We own two cars. We have children, and I'm successful in my career. And I understand exactly what Bill said. Exactly. And then our oldest one gets diagnosed with leukemia. Oh, man, you talk about a bummer. And so we go through all that. Well, we the chemotherapy, the radiation therapy, all the things associated with that. And he goes into a remission. And so another promotion, another transfer, you know, new place. Everything's fine. Seeing the doctors there. And this guy has a relapse. Now, here's the interesting thing about childhood leukemia. It is much more difficult to get back into remission after a relapse. Huh. Yeah, I heard a couple of people go, huh. Sound familiar? For those of you that have relapsed in our disease, how much more difficult is it to get that lightning in the bottle the second time? Wow. Much more difficult, but managed to get Scott back into remission the second time. I still have to take these exams and for promotions and all that stuff. And you guys understand that exactly what I'm talking about. Everybody, all the speakers were military. That's amazing. And has a relapse again. And in the meantime, our youngest son had been born. And he's a perfect match for a bone marrow transplant. Hope. There's now hope. And so Brenda and her mother and the children all take these little circular hops on Air Force planes because I was stationed on the East Coast and they're going to do this bone marrow transplant on the West Coast. It's the military. You'll get over it. It's the only place that did it. It's the only place that would even think about doing it for children these young. Our son Paul was the youngest bone marrow donor ever. And I think he still holds that record. And so they're out to Seattle. Now, what's missing from this formula? I don't go with them because I have to prepare for this next exam, for this next wicket that I'm running through in my professional career, because don't know it at the time, but I'm a selfish, self-centered jerk who's got some really screwy, misogynistic attitudes about what my life should be. You see, I'm the guy, I work, I earn the money, you take care of the stuff. And that was stuff. How selfish and self-centered is that? So they go out there, they do the bone marrow transplant. I finish that little doodah that I'm going. I go out there. I'm there for a little bit. I'm able to give him some platelet transfusions and so forth, and it looks like things are going okay. To make a long story short, he relapses again. They say, you might as well take him home. He'll last about a month. We bring Scott home, 30 days to the day. Scott dies. It was Sunday, May 8th. For those of you that crunch a few numbers, that's the second Sunday in May. That's Mother's Day. Mother's Day has never been quite the same around our house. I told you I was raised in that Protestant mainstream religion. Went to church, flipping a fiver in the plate. Any relationship that I thought I might have had with God at that point is severed. I'm pissed at him because he's obviously pissed at me, and it doesn't matter which one of us started the pissing contest. But I don't want anything to do with him because I am so self-centered that I think he is punishing me by killing my child. And I crawl into the bottle and I crawl into myself and I have no support to my wife who's also lost her child, to my parents who've lost their first grandson, to the other children in my house. I simply pour myself into work and drinking. I get out of the Navy, have that successful career, get out of the Navy, start these companies, get that big job where I'm the regional engineer. And the company changed hands. The new owner, in a real short period of time, figured out that perhaps, just perhaps, he could run his company without my engineering expertise and my unlimited expense account. I got fired. For the first time in my life, I had failed at something. That's okay. I know how to start companies. Yeah, it's hard enough to do when you're sober, semi-sober, sometimes sober. It's impossible to do when you're drunk all the time. From that point on, it was daily drinking. I discovered the miracle of the morning drink, which many of you talk about. And it was not to get drunk. It was just to get well. I just wanted to get enough in me so that my hand could maybe hold a pencil and write something. I could work on a report. So that's how it started, going downhill and downhill and downhill to where I have no money coming in at all, but I'm still living like the big shot who's making all that money. I own an office building on Main Street in the thriving metropolis of Montgomery, Pennsylvania. which is really where I live. Not, it's near Williamsport. But I knew that if we came to Atlanta and told everybody we lived in Montgomery, they'd think I was 2 hours away. So I'm a magician. Here's what happens. I can take an IRA, a 401k, an office building, and nearly $100,000 equity in a home and turn them into a vodka bottle. Poof! It's magic! Because I'm still living like the big shot. But I cannot be an alcoholic because I'm not under the bridge. I still got a house. I still got a garage. I still got two cars. I have a house for the cars in the garage, you know. I can't be an alcoholic. And it's going down and down. The last 2 years, I wasn't drawing a sober breath. About 2 years before I got sober, my brother, who got sober, called me and he said, "Look, I got to talk to you." I said, "Sure, I'll meet you at the Shamrock for lunch." You can figure out what kind of place the Shamrock is. I'll tell you what, they serve food there. I know they serve food there. I've seen the food bill on my credit card statement. So I must have ordered food there. So I get there and slam three doubles before my brother shows up so that I'm not shaking so bad. And here's what he said. Get out your notebook because this is the perfect 12-step call. My brother said to me, he said, "Samuel, I love you, and I'm never going to harp about this again, but I got to tell you, you have the same disease that I have. And if you decide that you ever want to stop drinking, call me. But I promise you, I'm never going to bring this up again." I said, "Fine, I'll see you later." Fast forward 2 years. I'm out in the garage. Somehow it's better out in the garage, you know. I'm out in the garage drinking all the time. My wife's in the house crying because the man she loves is out in the garage killing himself one drink at a time. And there's nothing she can do about it. She can't love me back into the world. And I'm going to have a drink. Now, I know that some of you swill because I've heard your stories. But I'm an officer and a gentleman. I don't swill. I drink cocktails. I want you to know I'm going to have a Cape Codder or a Seabreeze. You know, you get out the Collins glass and you put the ice in there, you know, and you put a jigger of vodka and then you fill it up with cranberry juice and you squeeze the lime and put the lime on top. You put the swizzle stick in there and the little, doesn't that sound refreshing? Oh, my. And so, you know, I'm a little low on ice and, you know, that's okay. I don't need the ice. The cranberry juice is cold. And I'm running low on cranberry juice and that's okay. That's okay. Just a splash for color. And the swizzle sticks, that's the swizzle stick, right? And the umbrellas, it's not raining, you know. Besides, if it were, my drink doesn't need protected from the rain. And somehow the Collins glass changed, and I'm going to have a drink. I know it's a drink because the red plastic tumbler says solo on the bottom. That means one, right? And I'm out in the garage, and I'm trying to pour the vodka. I'm talking quality stuff here. It was either Banker's Club or Kamchatka. From the half-gallon bottle. Why do I buy it in half gallons? Because they don't make it in gallons. Got to get a new half gallon every day. And I'm trying to get the vodka from the half gallon bottle into this red plastic tumbler. Because I know that if I get it in there and I get it to my lips and I get a little bit down, comes back up. That's okay. 3, 4, 5 times. Little sip, stays down. Little sip, get that tumbler in me. Pour the next one. Get that in me. Okay. Okay. So this morning, I'm trying to do that very same thing. I'm trying to get the vodka into the tumbler because I know I got to get these two solo tumblers of vodka into me before I can even do anything. And I'm shaking so bad. I'm not talking hands shaking. I'm talking whole body shaking. I'm talking like a poodle pooping peach pits shaking. You know, that kind of shaking. I'm trying to get it. It's spilling all over my hands. I can't get the vodka from the bottle into the tumbler. And I say I say this prayer that everyone in this room who's here, who started in recovery, everyone has said this prayer. Maybe not this exact words, but I said this. God, I can't do this anymore. Then I called my brother and I said, John, I can't do this anymore. My brother John said, do you know how long I've been praying for this phone call? I'm coming to get you. And he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not go to treatment center. I did not go to detox. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. Neither he nor I understood the danger of detoxing untreated. And in fact, it can be fatal. So if any of you new people in here are detoxing right now, do not leave this room without talking to me or one of these people in the front row, because you're in the danger zone. That doesn't mean there's no hope. It just means that we got to make sure that you don't have a seizure and die before we can detox you a little bit. Took me to my first AA meeting. Did you ever watch any of the Charlie Brown cartoons, the movies, especially around Christmas time? You know how the adults sound in a Charlie Brown cartoon? Wah, wah, wah. That's what I heard. I'm sure that they said some wonderful things, but I haven't a clue what it was. Because, you see, I don't remember what they said, but I remember how they treated me. They treated me with kindness and love. And every once in a while, some words would slip through that I would remember. It'll get better. It doesn't always have to be like this. I used to feel the same way. A lot of good shares. I'm sure there were. The last guy that shared was sitting at the end of the table, and he was Mr. Clean. Not Dudley Do-Right, Mr. Clean, you know. I'm talking the shaved head, you know, the earring, shoulders that wide, Mr. Clean. He was that guy. He looked right at me and he says, you got to quit lying. And that pissed me off because, you see, I'm the pillar of personal integrity. Just ask me. But he almost instantly added, especially to yourself. And that scared me. This guy had been spying on me. I don't like him. I'm going to give him a wide berth. His name is Harry. And hardly a day goes by we don't text or talk. I can count on my fingers the number of times we've been in the same room together and haven't hugged. Because Harry had the courage to tell me the truth. And my brother had already selected my sponsor for me, and he introduced me to my sponsor, and it was not Harry. Now, you know me, I'm the conservative military guy, and he introduces me to this long-haired, draft-dodging, dope-smoking hippie freak. He even had a ponytail, for God's sake. What is this guy going to teach me? A lot. If I'm willing to listen. And so we started through the steps. So we're going through the steps, I'm at my desk in my office. I used to have an office building on Main Street when I was a big shot, but somehow it went poof. So now the office is one of the bedrooms in the house. It's actually the youngest boy's bedroom, because the children are grown and gone now, the one that was the bone marrow donor. And so I'm at the office, and I'm reading the assigned page, and I'm on page 62, and there's this, you know, he's God, he's the principal, and we're the agent. And then there's this line, he is the father, and we are the children. And I closed the book, and I set it aside, and I said, that's it. I'm done with AA. I'm 57 years old. I've been in charge of real men, real equipment. People's lives depended on what I said and did. I am not a child. I'm done with this crap. So I'm getting ready to leave the office and go out to the job site. Now, the job I had then, amazingly enough, is the same job that I still have now. I go to construction sites and do the inspections. So I'm getting ready to go to the first construction site, do the inspection. And now my wife, I've already explained to you the stay-at-home mom thing. After our kids left home, it was time to have more kids, I guess. And we weren't having any. So, you know, when I'm on Social Security and Medicare, I'm still tripping over tricycles and stepping on Legos at my house. What's wrong with this picture? Because she's mom. There's always children at our house. People are begging her to keep their preschoolers. She's got a waiting list because she's not a daycare center. She's mom. Or as time went on, some of the other ones say, my other grandmom. So anyway, she's keeping little ones. I'm getting ready to go out the door. This little guy comes in. He's a toddler. I don't know, three, four, five years old. And his shirt proudly proclaims, my name is No-No. I said, my God, that's the funniest thing I've ever seen. We got to get one of those for our grandson. Now, if you haven't been around toddlers for a while, let me explain this to you. You know, he's over there putting a paperclip into the electrical outlet. No. You know, taking his sister's hair, sticking it in the blender. No. You know, stepping off of the curb. No. Oh, my God, we got to get one of those for our grandson. You know, this is awesome. And then, so I leave and I'm getting ready to go to work. I'm driving down the road, so I start thinking about this. You know, why does the father tell that child no? Is it because he's just some mean, vindictive jerk? I think not. Is it because he's so insecure he has to laud his authority over a child? I think not. He tells that child no. Because he loves him. And I used to say it occurred to me, but now I know better. It was then revealed to me that my Heavenly Father had been telling me no for a long time because he loved me. How much does he love me? That's beyond the scope of Alcoholics Anonymous, but if you want to talk about my understanding of God, I will be glad to share that with you after this meeting. But as I felt something and that was revealed to me, I started to tear up. Tearing up so much that I couldn't, the road was blurry. So I pulled off the side of the road because I got to wipe my eyes. When I pulled off to the side of the road, the floodgates opened, and I was not tearing up. I was bawling. I was sobbing like a schoolgirl with her first broken heart, just as these waves of emotion came over me that I had never felt in my life. Things happen in this world that are not your fault or mine. There are evil people who molest children. There are bad things that happen in war. People die. And there are diseases that will affect us and we will lose loved ones. And that's nothing that I had anything to do with. And that my family needed a father and a husband and a son. And I wasn't there. And I got that collection of fast food napkins out of the glove compartment that we all keep in there. I'm blowing my nose and I'm just sobbing and sobbing. And I don't know how long I sat there until it finally subsided. And I pulled back out on the road to head for the construction site. And I no sooner pulled out on the road and it started again. And I pulled over again, and napkins are gone now. I'm using my shirt, you know. And I realized that I was not supposed to go to work that day. I turned around and I went home. I went straight in the house. I said not a word to my wife and went right into the bedroom. And I got on my knees at the foot of the bed. And I said, Father, I will do whatever it is you want me to do to take this monster away. Now, those are not the words that are printed in our book in the third step prayer, but right after the third step prayer, it says the words don't really matter. I don't know about you, ladies and gentlemen, but I got a lot of monsters in my closet. I've shared three of them with you here this morning. I spent the rest of that day studying, not skimming, not reading, studying this lifeline, this big book, and cross-referencing it to the other big book, the big book. And I was transformed. And we went through the rest of the steps. And some of the speakers this weekend have talked about some marvelous things on the steps, especially the four-step and the amend step, the nine step. But I want to say to you that probably one of the most misunderstood steps is the four-step. Because I can't fix me, and I can't ask God to fix me until I know who me is. And I didn't know. I was an engineer. I was a naval officer. Because what I did was who I was, and I wasn't that anymore, so who was I? I'm not going to talk a whole lot about the four-step, except that if you are guiding someone through the steps, please provide specific direction. Get started on your four-step is not specific direction. It's in the book. Look at the three columns. Is not specific direction. When I guide guys through the steps, it takes about 40 days. Say, whoa, man, this isn't a race. Well, then I guess you're not my kind of drunk, because we have a small window of opportunity where I am completely compliant. I'm going to do exactly what you tell me to do, when I'm going to do it right now, because I want this. I've got to have this to survive. And if I don't do it during that window of opportunity while I am compliant, my ego is going to come back. Dr. Thibault, you'll see him mentioned in one of the appendix in our book. It looks like Thibault, but it's pronounced Thibault. Said this, and I can't remember which of our references it's in. I think it's AA Comes of Age. But anyway, he said this. He said, Dr. Thibault says, I have never seen anything with the recuperative powers of an alcoholic's ego. And after that line in my book, I wrote in pencil, no kidding. Wow. So that's why I get them through the steps. People are scared to sponsor because they think they've got to take somebody on to raise. I'll tell you what, Dr. Bob never took anybody on to raise. They weren't calling him a year later saying, do you think I should get a new job? You know, think I should get married? What do you think of this chick? You know, that none of that happens. Because if you're relying on your sponsor for your daily directions, then I suggest that perhaps you still have an alcoholic mind and you need to look at how you've done the steps. Don't rely on me or any other human being to be your source of power, because all human beings are flawed. The whole purpose of this, when we get to step 12, says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. So our book tells us in the literature, the big book says, The one question we have to ask, what do I do next? So at first, I ask my sponsor. You ask your sponsor, what do I do next? Because that's the only sane, sober person you know. But pretty soon you're starting to make some friends. You know, about 3 or 4 days into this, I put the guys on a dial-a-drunk-a-day program. Where I come from, they pass out these meeting cards, has all the meetings in the district, and all the guys in the room, for the men, put down their name and phone number. For the women, all the women put down their name and phone number. I tell them, I want you to get all those lists out. First of all, it's fun to see how many names show up on all the lists. You know, those are the guys that are going to a lot of meetings. But I want you to call one of those guys. Every day you're going to call another guy on the list. Because you're on the Dial a Drunk a Day program. He says, what do I say? I said, it doesn't matter what you say. You can start off with, look, my sponsor's got me on the Dial a Drunk a Day program, and today's your day. And you know what? The conversation will start when he's done laughing. Man, oh man. So we're going to get through these steps. Going to do the ninth step. And I owed a lot of money. No, that's not really true. I owed a lot of money. And so I was going to declare bankruptcy. Now, by this time, I've got a real strong support group of friends around me, including that knucklehead Harry. And they said something really profound, like, oh, no, big shot, you spent all that money. You got to pay it back. To which I responded with something very spiritual. I said, shit. For 102 months, half of what we made went to pay all that back. On the last check, I wrote last one in the memo block, took a picture of it, sent it to my sponsor. For all this period of time, Brendan and I are living like paupers. Because I'm doing what I was told to do. Taking an action that I didn't believe would work. So that I could have a life that God wanted me to have. We're living like paupers. We agreed that there's not going to be any exchange of Christmas gifts during this period of time. And so, like the second Christmas after this all started, you know, under the tree there's this great big wrapped up package. She hands it to me and I said, really? No. She said, just open it. And so I opened it up. Now, the guys in the military know what a shadow box is, but for those of you that don't, let me explain it to you. It's a very thick picture frame into which you can put things that you want to show off on your I love me wall. You know, all your military decorations, you know, presidential pardons, you know, whatever's important to you. So I opened it up, and so here's this shadow box, and inside the shadow box is the shirt. Not one similar. Not one exactly like it. The shirt that that child was wearing that day when God chose a toddler to reveal himself to me. That shirt hangs on the wall in my office. And everyone who comes into my office gets to hear the story of how God used a toddler to save me because, you see, my name is No-No. I was that child. Having an office in your house requires some discipline. And basically, if the door is closed, I'm working on something that I either can't be disturbed with or don't want to be disturbed with, you know, doing some math calculations, drawing approvals, whatever it is. The door's closed and you have to pretend that I'm in the office on Main Street. And if it's important enough for you to talk to me that you would call me on the phone in the office in Main Street, then it's important enough to interrupt me. You know, for example, if the house is on fire, you may interrupt me. If you're curious as to what I want for lunch, don't interrupt me. But if the door is open, then I can be, you know, obviously I'm accessible. I'm working at my desk, and Brenda's walking down the hall, and she sticks her head in, and she says, I'm so glad you're back. And I looked up from my desk, and I said, did I go somewhere? She said, yes. It was far away, and I couldn't reach you. What are we like now? My sons used to say things to me like, Dad, what were you thinking? Now they call me up and say, Dad, what do you think? I cannot describe for you all of the miracles that happen in my life every day as a result of living the life that God wants me to live. I could talk a whole lot about things that I do during the day,
the 10th step inventory and all, but those are all in our book. If you don't have a book, get a book. If you have a book, read the book. If you've read the book, study the book. If you've studied the book, do what it says in the book. I would advise you to start with the first page that has ink. First couple of months, I missed all that stuff, as one of our other speakers said, because that was all that Roman numeral stuff. That's front matter. It doesn't matter. That was my thought. Karen introduced me as Samuel, and I referred to myself as Samuel. And I usually start my talk with the phrase, "I'm drinking from the saucer, for my cup runneth over." I didn't start it that way today because I wanted to say that if you're not fired up for AA after this weekend, your wood's wet. Do I call myself Samuel because I'm some pompous, pretentious, preppy person? Okay, I'll give you that. But that's not why. Remember that day at the foot of my bed, and I said what was my third step prayer for the first time. And I was transformed. Sam died that day, and Samuel was born. Here's the magic words that we all skip right over when we're reading the big book, right before the third step prayer. We were reborn. And so I refer to myself as Samuel to remind myself that I am a new creation in God. And I hope that I can share that with you anytime you want me to. My name is Samuel, and I am an alcoholic. I'm drinking from the saucer, for my cup runneth over. All right.